comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right. It's all right.
Welcome to Voices from the Front Lines. This is your co-host today, Manuel Criollo. I'm taking Eric's place. He's out in the East Coast doing some work. And we have a great show planned today. We're going to do from Ferguson to Los Angeles, discussing both, you know, sort of have we forgotten about Ferguson? It's only been a month and a half since the assassination of Michael Brown, and the news have moved on to other sort of pertinent issues that are in the world and, you know, nonsense. And so it's important for us to sort of keep it together and continue having this conversation. So today we'll be joined by a really great group of guests. We'll be first joined by Janelle George. She's an educational policy counsel with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and also Ashley Franklin with our very own Strategy Center Community Rights Campaign, to talk about the Department of Defense 1033 program that is arming our local school police and local law enforcement, much of what we saw that played out in Ferguson at the first half of the show. The second half will be joined by Montega Simmons. He's the chair of the Organization for Black Struggle in St. Louis, Missouri, and also with the Hands Up, Don't Shoot Coalition out there. It's going to be an important show, so stay tuned. Thanks. Welcome back. You're listening to Voices from the Front Lines. This is Manuel Criollo. You're listening to 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego. This is KPFK, and you, of course, can listen to us on the web at www.kpfk.org. Today, we're going to talk about both sort of post-Ferguson, what it means to a lot of the work that we're all doing on the ground, and obviously hear directly from people in St. Louis. But one important sort of aspect of the post sort of Ferguson realities was many of us saw in TV or heard it through the radio, heard the use of military weaponry by Ferguson police and all sort of the local law enforcement in St. Louis, Missouri. And many of us asked ourselves, well, how did law enforcement get their hands with many of this sort of high-powered military equipment? The answer is the Department of Defense 1033 program. And one important aspect of what we think is going to be important to sort of flesh out this set of conversation is not just that, of course, a lot of the accumulation of that weaponry has happened over the last 30 years that many groups have been trying to advocate or trying to raise, but more importantly, what's coming out onto light also is that much of this weaponry is also being delivered to many school police departments, for sure here in California, but throughout the country. And also, secondly, that there has been, of course, the use of that weaponry and giving that weaponry to also local law enforcement that cover many of our schools throughout the country. So to sort of join us on this very important topic, we have Janelle George. She's the Educational Policy Counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And later on, we'll listen to also have Ashley Franken from the Community Rights Campaign. I wanted to talk to Janelle because Janelle George, who's with the LDF of the NAACP, but also Appleseed, it's a group in Texas, spearheaded an important letter that was written to the Department of Defense, raising both the concerns and asking them to sort of reverse this policy of handing out this sort of military weaponry to local school police departments and also local law enforcement that works with schools. Janelle, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Janelle, why don't we just sort of back up for people who might be fresh to the story. As I said, I think many people, of course, saw a lot of the imagery that many sort of for the first time or in a very visual way saw a lot of sort of high-powered military weaponry used on community members out in Ferguson. The other reality, I guess, for many people who actually do live in high-impacted neighborhoods where law enforcement has done sort of nighttime raids and gang injunctions and a lot of the sort of use of the war on gangs and war on drugs that have played out in our own communities, have seen those sort of high-powered rifles. How did the Department of Defense start this 1033 program? What was the purpose of that program?
Well, I think you just alluded to that right there. The 1033 program began as an offshoot of the quote-unquote war on drugs. So it was used to provide local law enforcement with high-powered weaponry to be able to respond to drug traffickers. And later, post 9/11, it also became a source for addressing anti-terrorism efforts. Now, we all know that those most impacted by these efforts are black and brown communities, which is an unfortunate consequence of the, again, quote-unquote, war on drugs and anti-terrorism efforts. So the program was authorized under the National Defense Authorization Act in the 90s. It has been renewed, and later the language was extended to apply to local law enforcement for all reasons, not just for anti-drug trafficking efforts and anti-terrorism efforts, but any law enforcement efforts. So what the Department of Defense does is it actually will lend surplus military equipment to local law enforcement agencies that apply for the program. Each state has a designated 1033 program coordinator who approves applications and forwards those to the Defense Logistics Agency, which is the department that actually administers a 1033 program under the Department of Defense.
So when you say lend, lend means almost like I'm borrowing and I plan to return back. I know one of the sort of conversations that we've had with a lot of our members here has been the concept that for a long time our sort of military department and Department of Defense has been, you know, obviously one of the few places that have never really seen that many sort of political cuts financially from our government. Is it also another way that the Department of Defense is also giving out weaponry that, in a sense, has in excess because of the amount of money that we're investing in sort of our military weaponry and Department of Defense?
Right. This really signals that there is such a surplus of equipment that it's available for use and lending to local law enforcement agencies. And, for example, you mentioned the cost of a mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, or MRAP vehicle, is around $700,030. The Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that you can employ a school counselor for a year for the cost of around $53,000. So it really does signal where our investment is going when local school districts are getting these kind of MRAP vehicles instead of federal funding going towards school counselors or other supports and services to assist students.
Well, you know, I was in a panel about 2 weeks ago, and there was Peter Biebring, who's a lawyer at ACLU, one of the, you know, sort of lead lawyers that they have there. And he was given testimony, and one of the things that I thought that he raised so importantly here in Los Angeles is that the Los Angeles Police Department, which had been under a consent decree for many years because of many of their actions in the past around racial profiling, around sort of the post sort of Rampart scandal that happened here in Los Angeles, that, you know, here you had one side of the government, the Department of Justice, holding them accountable for issues of racial profiling and racial discrimination. And on the other hand, you have the Department of Defense handing them assault rifles and other sort of military weaponry that obviously in some ways they both go hand in hand. And, you know, it also made me think a lot about some ways I've always thought about sort of political government and political state as sort of one format. But in reality, many of the formats are fighting against each other and sort of often sort of clashing in their own interest. You know, obviously, given that, you know, the Strategy Center has done a lot of work around ending the school-to-prison pipeline, and, you know, we'll get to the specifics here in Los Angeles, that it's also, to me, sort of what's very disheartening is that here you have the President Obama at the beginning of the year in the Department of Justice and, to a certain degree, the Department of Education raising the issue around the racialized impacts of a school-to-prison pipeline and even raising the importance of needing for school police departments and school police to sort of be limited in their role of discipline, limit, you know, sort of the role of how their actions criminalize sort of everyday behavior, and yet in some ways that this Department of Defense programming can still be evolving at the same time. How do you sort of understand that as a contradiction that really is playing out?
You know, I think that's such a good point. It is really about lack of coordination and lack of communication. The Senate Homeland Security Committee had a hearing about Ferguson and militarization, and seated at the table were some officials from the Department of Justice and the Department of Defense, and one senator, Claire McCaskill, asked the witnesses, do you all talk to each other? Is this the first time that you've sat at the table together? And they said yes. So that really exemplifies the fact that there is a lack of coordination. And I will say, I don't think it's a lack of willingness. You mentioned the Department of Defense, I'm sorry, the Department of Justice and the Department of Education issued joint guidance on discipline and really provided recommendations for less punitive alternatives to disciplinary practices. So they are engaged in this, but all parties have to be at the table. Everyone has to be engaged, and that includes the Department of Defense. I think the fact that a lot of people weren't aware that the 1033 program was supplying military equipment, specifically military, including military weapons, to local school districts, highlights the fact that we need more transparency, we need more communication, and we need more coordination, not only between all the different agencies in government, but with the general public as well.
That is Janelle George. She's Educational Policy Counselor at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Her organization and also Appleseed from Texas led an effort to write an important letter to the Department of Defense urging them to end their sort of involvement with lending military weaponry to school police departments and law enforcement that is engaged in schools through the Department of Defense 1033 program. Here in California, as you know, Janelle, I've seen at least some of the reporting that's coming out. The Baldwin Park School Police Department, I mean, Baldwin Park is a very small city here in the region, got 3 M16 assault rifles. Kern High School Department, who has a set of reported sort of incidents of racialized sort of school police sort of issues and also sort of suspension expulsions of young people for things like, you know, willful defiance. They got 30 magazine pouch for M4 assault rifle ammunition. Of course, our own local school police department here in Los Angeles School Police Department, the largest school police department in the country, got 61 M16 assault rifles, 3 M79 grenade launchers, 1 mine-resistant vehicle, this MRAP vehicle that you were discussing. The Oakland Unified School District had a utility truck, and of course the San Diego Unified School Police Department also received one of these resistance vehicles. That's not to say also LAPD, and what I saw from sort of this spreadsheet that the California Safety Office released, it showed at least almost over 400 assault rifles to LAPD, close to 1,000 to LA sheriffs, I think a cargo plane for the LAPD. I mean, the list goes on and on, and really beg us to ask ourselves, you know, the sort of heightened use of this military weaponry and sort of what can all go wrong, which is what we saw in Ferguson. I wanted to bring on Ashley Franklin, who's an organizer with the Community Rights Campaign and the Strategy Center, to talk a little bit about the work that they're doing here in Los Angeles to sort of ask and urge the LAU Unified School District to return all this weaponry that they received. Welcome to the show, Ashley Franklin.
Thanks, Noah, for having me on the show. So I think what's important, work that's happening here in Los Angeles, is with all of the that we see that our government has, we have to understand, like you said, school police department across the nation, they have about 4 officers of a annual budget that's $1 million a year. So with that being said, that people have...
Ashley, let me ask you: are you on still or are you moving? Because it's coming on and off your phone. Janelle, why don't you talk to us about the letter that you guys sent to the Department of Defense? Have you gotten a response? How many groups signed on to it? And sort of what are the core demands that you put in that letter?
Sure. I do want to make one point, you know, and that refers back to what you mentioned about the climate in Ferguson. We're talking here about weapons, we're talking about M16s, grenade launchers, et cetera, but I don't want us to focus on the weapons to the exclusion of the underlying issues that are playing out between communities of color and police. And that's really the issue here, the underlying tensions, the underlying implicit bias, and frankly, racism that's playing out. And that has to be addressed, in addition to definitely removing these weapons as well. But we have to really address these tensions between communities of color and police, whether it's in schools or it's in the streets of Ferguson or Los Angeles or whatever city we're referencing. That underlying issue has to be addressed. And I think that what happens with the militarization when we insert these weapons, it really just highlights the existing tensions and really exacerbates those tensions. So what our letter asked was, number one, for more transparency, to know the full extent of participation of school districts in the 1033 program. And number two, along the lines of that transparency, to know exactly what materials they're receiving. So through the 1033 program, districts can get materials such as laptops or computers. So we want to have a full accounting. What exactly are districts receiving? What is the full extent, especially related to weaponry? And just to have more transparency in the program. We did receive a reply from the Defense Logistics Agency saying that specifics related to the exact equipment each district was getting could not be provided for security reasons, that they did provide data at the county level. But again, that doesn't tell us what the school districts are receiving or what kind of equipment could be present in any particular school. What we have is a compilation of information from DLA, the Defense Logistics Agency, as well as news reports, which vary. So to be honest, we don't know the full extent of how school districts are armed or the full extent of the weaponry that school police have. And going back to the issue of the tensions between communities and color and the police, we already know that in a lot of school districts where police are armed with tasers and with pepper spray, those things are being misused. There was a student in Texas, and this was an incident Texas Appleseed highlighted, who suffered a traumatic brain injury after being tasered by a school police officer. So if these items like pepper spray and tasers are being misused, we can't imagine what can happen when you insert even more high-powered weapons. But again, if we don't deal with the underlying issues and talk honestly and frankly about those issues and why we have such an increased police presence in schools, and particularly in schools serving high numbers of students of color, we're really not learning the lesson of what Ferguson is telling us. And even though, as you mentioned, this was just a month away, we can't let the lessons be lost. We just can't risk that because we'll be at risk to repeat them.
That's Janelle George. She's Educational Policy Counselor at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. We're talking today about Ferguson, law enforcement, and sort of the innate sort of racism plays out in much of those, the use of law enforcement are in our sort of modern day society. And of course, then the sort of current revelation or the current sort of insight that many have come to talk about at the Department of Defense 1033 program, which is the use of military weaponry or the lending of military weaponry from the Department of Defense to many local law enforcement, including our school police departments. You know, I think what you just said, Janelle, is very important in that this question about, for many of us who are doing this work to try to end the school-to-prison pipeline, you know, I don't think for many people on the day-to-day, if they don't send their children to local public school, which has sort of a large number of students of color, I don't think most people can even comprehend how large police departments that we have. As you know, here in Los Angeles, the LA Times did some very excellent sort of commentary and sort of opinion pieces about sort of the information that was revealed about sort of this use of military weaponry. And very interesting, as you read a lot of the pieces, the writers themselves were sort of, whoa, I had never really thought about how large and how big this police department is here in Los Angeles. I mean, we're talking about close to 408 police officers and security guards. We're basically speaking about having one police officer for every middle school and high school throughout here of LA Unified. And I think that one of the core pieces that you're raising, which is that what a lot of people could sort of be shocked about militarization, but in many ways sort of the day-to-day criminalization that plays out, the day-to-day sort of suppression that plays out in many of our communities is so prevalent and so sort of in your face that, you know, it's sort of just, this is almost like the last topping of what you can only imagine of your community sort of facing. Again, let me try to see if we can have Ashley Franklin. Ashley, why don't we talk about some of the work that's being done here in Los Angeles around these issues and, of course, sort of broadly as the work of the community rights have been doing over the past years.
Hi, could you hear me?
Yes, of course.
Okay, great. I know I was breaking up a little bit, and I hear an echo. Is that happening on your end as well?
No, go ahead.
Okay, perfect. So, just, you know, I think it's important to lay out some of the numbers that you mentioned before around our school police department to the extent of how deep and how far spread they are, in the sense that we have the largest school police department across the nation with a 400-person sworn officers. And then they have about $70 million of an annual budget, right? So given those factors, I think it's very clear that that budget has been used for many years, in which we've been fighting against around the criminalization of young people, around citations, arrests that's been happening on school sites. And so for a lot of the young people who've been fighting to really curb some of those actions, curb some of the things that our young people are being criminalized for, they have taken up a real reflection around, like, what they've seen in Ferguson, what they experience on a daily basis in their community, as a way of understanding that these weapons aren't simply for protection, but they question, who are they trying to protect? They question, are these weapons there because they are there for their safety, or they see the black and brown youth as a threat to safety? They're questioning, are they using these weapons to suppress a movement, to suppress people who are fighting back, to challenge some of the conditions that they're seeing inside of their community? So young folks have been on their campuses spreading the word about these weapons. First and foremost is getting the word out there with as many community members as they can possibly get. The second thing that has happened with the community rights campaign is we've written to all of the school board representatives to say that, one, we don't think that these weapons should be on campus, marking that. Number two, saying that those weapons should be returned. And the second thing is we really want folks to understand is that we need a complete inventory from LAUSD about how many of these weapons exist. We understand that the one tank, the 66 rifles, the three grenade launchers are all a product of this year, but if they've been receiving these weapons over the years, we need to understand how many do they already have in their possession. And the third thing is, once they give those weapons back, we understand that our sheriff's department, our LAPD department, are all departments that are inside of our communities, that are around our school. And so we want our LAUSD board to also urge them to, you know, give those weapons back as well. So not only have young folks been out in the community talking about these issues, they've also been a part of writing the letter. They've gone to the school board to give testimony to say that this isn't what they see as something that will help them through their educational process, but they see it as a real suppression tool used inside of their communities. And then the last thing is folks are gearing up, and they're going to have a vigil and a rally next Friday to say that, one, we want to honor the lives of the people who've already passed away at the misuse of these weapons inside of our community, so many people who've been killed by officers inside of our community. But also, we want to raise awareness and call out our school district to ensure that they give these weapons back and they acknowledge that this isn't the type of road or path that they want to take for the young people, to ensure that they actually graduate and not get harmed by the hands of officers.
That's Ashley Franklin. She's the lead organizer of the Community Rights Campaign and with the Strategy Center. And we're also joined by Janelle George, who's the Educational Policy Counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. We're talking about Ferguson. We're talking about police violence. We're talking about the Department of Defense 1033 program. And, of course, you're listening to Voices from the Frontlines. My name is Manuel Criollo. I'm your co-host for today. And, I think what we hear in both of you, Ashley and Janelle, that it seems like one of the most striking parts of this discussion is two things. One is that everybody's really trying to ask, now that we know that at least this program exists, is what is the level of kind of military weaponry that police departments are getting through this program as an important sort of first tactic to just even know what we're dealing with? Because as both of you said, on one hand, you have at least we've seen the California Janelle, we've seen, at least here in California, we saw the release of sort of a spreadsheet that sort of lays out much of this sort of weaponry by department, by city. Very important. I don't know if you have it. I will send it to you, that we got from the governor's office, that was pretty available online. And as Ashley said, we also have called the police chief here in Los Angeles, did ask him more directly, given the relationship we've had with him for these many years, what was the nature of this weaponry, and was it even true? Because it did feel like one of those things that, you know, you read on The Onion, you know, that, you know, because school police departments are getting grenade launchers and, you know, and tanks and this sort of conversation that you can't even sort of fathom. So it seems like this demand about even knowing what they have sort of becomes very critical, because both two realities will come out. One is that it at least lays out for the public very clearly what they have. But two, I think one of the things that I think we're going to be all surprised also is that not only the weaponry that they get from 1033, but also the weaponry that they themselves buy.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. I just want to echo everything that Ashley said. I think she made really great points, and I want to underscore a particular thing that she raised, and that's that we can't conflate school safety with school discipline. School police are actually being misused to handle routine discipline matters. Ashley mentioned ticketing and citations. These are minor offenses. These are minor infractions that are sending students in disproportionate numbers out of school, pushing them out of school, and often into the juvenile justice system. And that's what's really, really harmful here. And I agree, going back to the point about transparency, we need full transparency in terms of the full extent of the participation in the program so that we know what's out there. And I will add, too, I'm hearing recent reports that Los Angeles School Police Department returned 3 grenade launchers. So that's somewhat good news.
Yeah, I mean, we did hear that last week. We also know that the city of Davis, you know, which Davis had during the sort of Occupy sort of movement, had such a, you know, high limelight, where, you know, law enforcement was using, as in the letter that you guys wrote, Janelle, to explain how even the misuse of mace and, you know, sort of other type of like weaponry, sort of everyday weaponry, forget sort of deadly high powered military weaponry that we all know is being used. Right. We know that the San Diego School Police School Board also has decided that they want to return the MRAP vehicle that they received. So clearly there's an important sort of beginning of this movement, and I think it's important that we all sort of keep in touch and try to have this conversation. Both, as you're saying, I think one of the things that strikes me, and I wanted to ask this sort of to end with both of you, is that I'm a very optimistic person in many ways, and often think that the critical aspect is going to be sort of the importance of mobilizing our people and getting the word out and really confronting really the last 30 years of mass incarceration and criminalization that's played out in our communities. You know, one of the things that, though, really is hard for us to sort of understand is that, you know, less than a month ago, you know, we at the Strategy Center did a pretty massive citywide press conference with many of the superintendent, board members, the chief of police. As you laid out, Janelle, we finally signed an agreement that sort of said police is going to stop criminalizing sort of everyday behavior in schools, that they would limit their role. And for this to come out, how are both of y'all, given that you guys are doing some front lines work in this work, how are you coming into grips of understanding sort of this dynamic between, on one hand, we're making some important inroads, and yet, you know, sort of the gap of between that and then you hear both military weaponry, or what happened to Michael Brown, or what happened to Ezell Ford here in Los Angeles. How do we sort of understand that gap and sort of both keep our eyes on the prize and yet sort of also be very reflective of the work that we're doing?
I think that we really do recognize the victories, even if it's small things like some weapons being given back, or I think this is a huge victory with the memorandum of understanding with the police. Those are victories, and I think we can claim those and count those, but we also have to keep our eyes on the task before us, which again is addressing the underlying issues and talking frankly about racism, talking about these interactions, because if we don't and we continue to focus on some of the tangential issues, these incidents will continue to recur. So we really have to keep our eyes on the work ahead to address the underlying implicit bias, to address the racism, to address what's fueling the presence of police in K through 12 schools at all. So we really have to do the work of focusing on that, raising those issues, having those uncomfortable discussions. And to some extent, law enforcement has raised weighed in on this. The consensus report, consensus of state governments issued a report with input from law enforcement saying that law enforcement didn't want to be involved in routine discipline issues. That's not what they're trained for. That's not their expectation. So we have to get back to the essence of what discipline is. It's a part of education. It's meant to teach and to guide, not to push students out of school.
Ashley?
I think, you know, I consider myself a very hopeful person as well. And I think that it can be, at first sight, seeing this military weapon inside of our communities. And let's be real, this military weapon has existed inside of our communities. Mm-hmm. It may not be in wrapped tanks, but we've mm-hmm. always had that. We've always had SWAT teams. Mm-hmm. We've always had all of these days where they disperse inside of our communities to do normal, you know, what has become normal, the check-ins on our communities. As for searching, arresting, handcuffing our folks and gang unit days, like we understand that this is constant. This is something that always happens. But I think what gives me the hope is reflecting on two things. Number one is that we're able to have these huge victories to restrict and define the role of officers inside of our campus. I think that that's a huge victory in the sense that they realize that people are on the ground and they're moving and they're fighting back, and so they have to ease up and actually give things to the community because we're fighting like crazy to make it a reality. Mm-hmm. The second thing that I have to, you know, acknowledge is the fact that the officers, the police departments, are putting these things inside of our community, not because of, you know, the safety of our community, but I think it's because they see the real threat of the masses. I think they see the threat of us organizing. They see the threat of us being tired of the conditions that we've been faced with, and now we are fighting back. We are, you know, L.A. could be the next Ferguson. We will take to the streets. We will get what our communities have wanted and deserved. So I think that, for me, those are two signs of a real victory of a movement, and it definitely is something that keeps me hopeful at night. And I think in the most plain sense, at the end of the day, if we have our community, we're out there, we're organizing, we're having these victories, I think that our folks are being politicized on an everyday basis from when we talk to them and raising their conscience about all the things that's happening, what does a real demand on our school districts, on our cities really look like. That's one amazing piece. But the second thing is then the reaction of what happens when we're out there in the streets and folks get to see and feel what a real police state looks like, that only gives more fuel for people to want to fight back. Mm. So I think that, you know, it is kind of disheartening to see these military weapons on the ground, but I do think it shows the power of a movement. It shows that they're getting ready because they know that we're out there organizing and we're willing to fight back.
That's Ashley Franklin. She's with the Community Rights Campaign, and she's the lead organizer there. And we've also been joined by Janelle George. She's the Educational Policy Council, NAACP Legal Defense Fund. We've been talking about Ferguson, Los Angeles, police violence, and the Department of Defense 1033 program, and the work of both organizations and the work of many groups around the country, both trying to end the school-to-prison pipeline and also to try to reverse and end the 1033 program. I really want to thank you both. You've been listening to Voices from the Frontlines. Stay tuned. We'll be joined by Montega Simmons in the second half of the show, one of the organizers at the organization Black Struggle and Hands Up, to talk to us what's been playing out the last couple of weeks. Welcome back. You're listening to Voices from the Frontlines. I'm really honored to be joined by Montega Simmons. He's the chair of the organization of Black Struggle in St. Louis, Missouri, and also one of the important leaders of the Hands Up, Don't Shoot coalition work that's being done sort of post the Mike Brown assassination. Welcome to the show, Montega.
Thank you, Manuel. Good to hear from you, brother.
Good to hear from you, too. Well, Mantega's been sort of on the front lines in the Organization of Black Struggle and Hands Up and many of the, you know, sort of important key leaders of OBS and of course, many of the young people who sort of came to rise during the struggle, sort of post the killing of Mike Brown. Mantega, why don't you sort of help sort of the listeners understand what's played out over the last month in St. Louis, sort of post sort of when the news was sort of in the front lines. What has been some of the key work that you guys have been trying to sort of continue?
I'm not even sure where to start at this point.
Of course.
A few things that have taken place. First and foremost, they did obviously lift the state of emergency, which returned the power of the governor to recuse the current prosecutor back to the county. For those of you who haven't kept up with the story, the current prosecutor, Bob McCullough, has a long history of behavior that's given significant difference to police officers in police shootings. He and his family have a long history and relationship to the police. Also, there's a long and perceived history of racial animus from him and the way he's actually conducted business. We were actually pressing first for him to recuse himself, but also for the governor, while the state of emergency was in effect, to remove him and appoint a special prosecutor. So since that's taken place, what we have also seen is a response from the city government of Ferguson, where they rolled out a list of changes that they claimed they would actually institute, including civilian review. Most of the changes were very, very watered down, meaning we weren't talking about real effective civilian review with subpoena power or significant independence. And then some of the other structural reforms, like they did actually do a suspension in terms of like warrants, which is another bigger issue that, that spans the entire region. So they did call like a moratorium on those and pretty much negated all those outstanding warrants, which was a big victory for us. What else? As far as those who had actually been unjustly charged and arrested, all of those prisoners at this point, except for one, I believe, have been released. So there may still be one in custody, and he has a significant bond amount. So I think if he was not released this past weekend, he should hopefully be out by the end of this week. I'm trying to think of what other guy it feels like.
And so, and I'll, of course, and of course, as we know also that the grand jury, they are collecting now a testimony from many people during the grand jury process, right?
That's right. Now, two fronts here. One thing that's happened is the prosecutor has extended the date of the grand jury. Initially, we were expecting an indictment or non-indictment to come in the middle of October. He's extended that to the beginning of January. And in addition, the Department of Justice is also asserted, and they are here as well, investigating. Some of us who are actually part of the coalition will be meeting with them tomorrow as well. So they are on the ground doing an investigation in Ferguson beyond the scope of what was originally announced. But beyond that, they've also come into St. Louis County Police Department, which is a separate part of the municipality. They came in at invitation, which means it's a different type of investigation, to also look at patterns and practices and evaluate what the conditions are with that specific department.
And as what I can gather also, Mantega, that also because of what played out in Ferguson, and as you're just saying, that both some local municipalities are asking the Department of Justice to look into their practices. But I know that given that a lot of the work that the Organization of Black Struggle had been doing around police accountability, sort of the key issue of even having, you know, sort of just even city control of the local police in St. Louis, the other sort of thing that I think it seems, at least from far away, that has been sort of raised sort of post what played out in Ferguson is that also St. Louis itself, also many of the issues that people have been raising for many years are also of the St. Louis Police Department also beginning to at least have much more light that's coming out.
That's exactly right. 1 week after Mike Brown Jr. was killed, Kachin Powell was also killed in the city of St. Louis. What we've seen is, one, they did try to offer apparently a little bit more transparency initially, but we're seeing the same pattern of behavior still play itself out. They haven't released the identity of the police officers involved with the shooting. and have not announced whether they're actually going to do an indictment. Now, while the city does report to be moving forward like they are, like we've worked with Alderman Terry Kennedy for a long time to get effective civilian review, and his legislation appears to be moving on schedule, hopefully for introduction next week. At the same time, we still haven't gotten any traction with the police department. The chief did come publicly and disclose like information around use of force, but he wasn't willing to entertain any public questions for the city or for residents of the city. And at this point, they're still concerned about what could happen if the energy were to, quote-unquote, die down. So right now, they're still responding to the pressure that's been created in and around Ferguson, but there's still a sense of urgency on our part to continue to press forward.
We're talking to Montega Simmons. He's the chair of the Organization for Black Struggle in St. Louis, Missouri. You know, one of the key organizations that has been leading a lot of important struggles both in St. Louis for, you know, over 30 years, but of course sort of been sort of in the front lines sort of the post the assassination of Mike Brown Jr. Montega, you know, how are you holding up? I mean, you know, the Strategy Center was there 3 weeks sort of post a lot of the main sort of action that played out during sort of Labor Day weekend. That's almost been now close to 3 weeks. How are you holding up? I know much of the people, you as being one of the critical leaders along with, you know, a lot of important sort of community leaders and leaders that are in the region. How are you guys holding up? Have you guys had a chance to both rest? Get a chance to at least, you know, again, many multiple fronts, as you're saying, both because sort of what played out, but also the important sort of response and the visualization that a lot of people sort of can grasp the importance of what's playing out in Ferguson and in Missouri.
Yeah. When you were here, Manuel, I think most of us were averaging like 20-plus hours a day. Since then, I'd say we may have leaned back to, say, 18, something like that. I'm thankful for folks like you who actually came in to help support. But because of the intensity of what's still happening here, I don't know if you've seen, like, even this past weekend, there were confrontations with folks who actually were attacking protesters. So we still have to be really vigilant. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason, and I know you'll get to this later, we put out the call, because honestly, your presence actually helped re-energize us and inspire us to kind of go forward. So part of the reason we are looking for other folks to come in and help relift this is to make certain that as worn out as we are, the presence of other forces from out of town who are also fighting the same fight really invigorates and gives energy and new vision to the movement. So, again, we're greatly appreciative of the time that you guys were able to spend here on the ground with us.
We're talking to Montega Simmons. He's the chair of the Organization for Black Struggle. You're listening to KPFK, Voices from the Front Lines, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego. Well, thank you, Montega. I really appreciate that. And I do think let's get to the sort of core sort of ask that I know that Hands Up and other organizations in St. Louis and in Ferguson are making a national call of sort of weekend of action that you're calling for the week of October 11th, I believe. Why don't you talk to us about sort of what some of the sort of key goals, what are you hoping, how can people get a contact with y'all?
Sure. Primary way to make contact is actually through our website. It's FergusonOctober.com. What we're calling for is a weekend of resistance, and what we're asking is that those of you who can come to town, either that Friday on the 10th or that Saturday on the 11th, and what we want to do is engage in a weekend that bridges the calls and the energy that we have here in Ferguson and throughout St. Louis to the fights and struggles and the energy that's been expressed in cities around the country, from New York to Eric Garner and Oakland.
To SL Ford here in Los Angeles and Omar Abrego,
yeah.
Too, yes.
Exactly. But this is actually, again, a call to literally draw a line in the sand that says that we must resist, and that this is a movement that's not going anywhere. So we do want as many people that can stay. If you can stay through Monday, there'll be activities from Friday all the way through Monday. The city of St. Louis, as we all know at this point, will never be the same, but we're hoping to re-energize and say beyond even that weekend, carry that energy over to 022, October 22nd, where again, there should be another marshaling of energy against police brutality and repression against our communities, both in your cities and in ours.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Montega Simmons. He is the chair of Organization for Black Struggles. We're talking about an important call for action, and I think for many of our listeners out on the radio world, we hope that you really take seriously the call that many of the important key organizers in St. Louis and in Ferguson are making to people to participate on the weekend of resistance, October 10th, October 14th, and as Montega is saying, is sort of an important sort of launching pad also for the week after, at least both in St. Louis and I know across the country, as sort of the historical October 22nd police brutality and repression sort of mobilizations occur. Why don't we talk about, Montega, what do you guys hope to accomplish? Not just, obviously, the critical aspect of people supporting you. I know one of the critical sort of aspects of this mobilization also have a lot to do with what was at one time maybe the perceived sort of timeline when the grand jury was going to at least, it's to put a lot of pressure on the grand jury itself. To continue to sort of keep many of the sort of key demands that OBS and Hands Up and many of the organizations out in St. Louis and Ferguson are making around civilian oversight with subpoena power, you know, demilitarizing the police. As you, I don't know if you had a chance to hear the prior segment. We talked about the 1033 program and the actual arming of school police departments here in Los Angeles and across the country. So again, the critical aspect of, you know, mobilizing people around those critical questions. I know one of the things that you raised about both Ferguson and many sort of many of the small municipalities in St. Louis, this issue around bench warrants on people for sort of the most minor of crimes, but that once you get picked up, you can multiply be in jail for many, many, many days as you're trying to sort of clarify your pieces. What are some of the key sort of like things that you're hoping to accomplish through this mobilization in terms of some of the targets that you're hitting?
Some of the basic targets, I mean, first and foremost, just dealing with the case of Mike Brown, mm-hmm. Darren Wilson is actually still on leave, on paid leave. Mm-hmm. He has yet to be brought in and taken into custody. He testified, but he literally went back to his way of life. In addition, the Ferguson police chief has yet to be fired or held accountable for the course of events that took place throughout that weekend and for a series of lies in which he's been caught. This directly was in Ferguson. There's a whole line of levels of accountability that still need to be had. And part of the activities of that weekend will be focused on adding additional pressure in terms of what should be taking place locally. Beyond that, within the actual county and the city, this is, again, a show of force. It's a show that we're actually not going anyplace, and the demands that we've made, not only for things like effective civilian review, but for a change in their actual policies on use of force, and again, to the Department of Justice to take a stronger role in the case of the Ferguson Police Department to possibly take control of that department, must be met. Meaning that folks are going to stay in the streets and they're going to stay active no matter how long this takes. We believe that they actually extended the date in hopes that this would somehow go away. Mm. This is just kind of the first leg that shows we're not going anywhere. And for us, this is really about building energy for a much longer struggle that we know has to come.
Yeah, these are the words of Montega Simmons. He's the chair of the Organization for Black Struggle, key sort of organization doing a lot of important work with the Hands Up, Don't Shoot Coalition in St. Louis, really urging a lot of listeners, and hopefully people can sort of heed the call for a weekend of resistance that is going to happen in Ferguson and in the St. Louis region of October 10th and October 14th. I know, you know, given my own experience of being out in Ferguson, that I know one of the other key things that you guys have been raising in the cause, Montega, is that the idea also of also supporting the organizing that's playing out in the region, because in many ways, obviously, there's been a lot of activities for many, many years, but it's re-energized both some key new folks into the work, but also a lot of new people who are really new to organizing really new to resistance. And so one of the key aspects that you're trying to also raise is that people with different skills, organizers, artists, healers, can actually have that type of exchange to support some of the work that's also happening locally in that weekend. So I think that's also a lot of different ways that people can participate that weekend. Can you give us again, where people can get a hold of you, and where they can talk to you?
Okay. Primary contact in regard to the actual mobilization is the website FergusonOctober.com. If you want direct information for the Organization for Black Struggle, our website is obs-onthemove.org. And the phone number for us would be 314-367-5959.
Thank you, Montega. That's Montega Simmons. He's with the Organization for Black Struggle. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for the work that you're joining you. My name is Manuel Criollo. I'm your host for today for Voices from the Frontlines. I really want to thank Montega Simmons. I really want to thank Janelle George of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and Ashley Franklin of the Community Rights Campaign of Talking About Ferguson to Los Angeles. Let's continue the important work.
Here comes the sun.